How's the mic? Can you hear me in back? Great. Okay, so today I'll be telling you about an area of research in physics, which is called physics education research. It might sound to you crazy that you should tag the word research to education. Aren't they two distinct activities? In fact, they can be brought together, and there's no reason not to use our scientific skills on anything we deal with in the realm of physics, including educating. Okay, so that's what I'll talk about today. This is work that I did in collaboration with Sarah McKagan at the University of Colorado Boulder. As John kindly mentioned in his introduction, I'm at the Colorado School of Mines, and I'm funded by the National Science Foundation. Okay, so today I'll tell you about an introduction to PER, as we call it, physics education research in general, and then I'll talk about four areas in... can you see my pointer in back? Yes. I'll talk about four areas in which physics education in quantum mechanics specifically can be improved. That is the textbook, the course content, and everybody, I think, thinks about these. This is going to be pretty new, teaching methods, and this is where we do the science, the assessment tools. What are the measures we apply to determine whether or not we have succeeded in improving a course? Hopefully the measure is better than, you know, did the students come to class and did they drop the course or not, right? Okay, so the School of Mines is set in Golden, Colorado. These are a few various scenes from around our university. It's a lovely area, and the main focus of our university is earth, energy, and environment. And so everything we do is related to these themes in some way. Now, this is my group at the School of Mines, and, you know, primarily I do traditional research. All these guys are doing many-body theory, nonlinear dynamics, etc. And my group works in three main areas. In quantum many-body theory, as mentioned, in artificial materials, and in nonlinear dynamics. If you have time, you're welcome to come to my talk tomorrow and hear about my work in these two areas. That'll be on ultra-cold molecules, I believe, at 11 o'clock. Is that right? Okay. But today, I'm going to tell you about physics education research. So let me first motivate you with why you should even reform this course. I mean, hey, I took this course, right? I ended up a quantum many-body theorist and a faculty member. It worked for me. Why should I try to change it, right? Well, let me explain why. So first thing is, when you look at the history of quantum mechanics, you can divide it into four main periods, right? In my view and the view of many of my colleagues. The first period, there was the initial development of quantum mechanics by Born and Schrodinger and Dirac. We have wave mechanics. We have matrix mechanics. You know, we have a lot of the basic ideas of quantum mechanics appearing, obviously the Schrodinger equation. In the second period of quantum mechanics, people went on to adapt these fundamental ideas in quantum mechanics to quantum field theories, to many-body theories, to all kinds of areas in physics, to particle physics, okay? But they stopped thinking about why quantum mechanics works the way it does. So in the first 10 years, you know, there was a lot of debate about the meaning of quantum mechanics, the meaning of the wave function. I'm sure everybody here has, you know, sat up some dark late night with, you know, alcohol thinking about it all night. But, it you know, at some point you just kind of put it down and do calculations. And so the way I was taught was quantum mechanics. The way I was taught quantum mechanics was the following. When I went to graduate school, University of Washington, I won't say who my professor was. On the first day of class, he said, this is how I feel about the interpretation of quantum mechanics. Not interesting. Done. And then he went on to do the rest of the class. Okay? So that's sort of the attitude that comes into a lot of courses. Well, in 1964, there was a very important paper put out by Bell about actually measuring some of these more so-called philosophical ideas in quantum mechanics. Okay? Now, as soon as you can bring, you know, philosophy into measurement, we call it science, and then scientists are okay with thinking about it again. However, there really weren't any experiments to realize these ideas. So this is a really fertile period where a lot of theorists thought about a lot of different interpretations of quantum mechanics. Now, there were people occasionally thinking about it in period 2, but period 3, it starts to get a lot more fertile, okay? However, there really aren't any experiments. What happens is, in 1982, there's the first, you know, incontrovertible experimental evidence for Bell's inequalities, okay? And this was done by Alain Aspect, who's now a very eminent, more senior physicist, and it was done in France. And there were many such experiments since then involving, you know, foundations of quantum mechanics, involving quantum information processing, leading to the idea of creating a quantum computer. So a lot of these foundational ideas and foundational interpretations of quantum mechanics have led to practical technology. Yeah, we now have a quantum computer with 8 qubits, right? We're sort of at the vacuum tube stage of quantum computing. But that is a major step forward. Without this foundational work, I don't think we would have gotten there. Okay, so first thing is, even in a technological sense, it's very important to address all four areas of quantum mechanics. Now, Sakurai is a really common text. How many people here have used Sakurai? Maybe nobody? Oh, a lot. Oh, good. Was that like every graduate student that just raised their hand? Okay, I use Sakurai too. So Sakurai is a great book, right? But Sakurai really only covers these first two periods of quantum mechanics. So if you have a field that has 80 years of development, why should you only cover the first 40, right? So my view, getting proficient in quantum mechanics was, hey, the courses can be improved. You'll be happy to hear about this in Canada. In the view of myself and many of my colleagues, the USA is very much behind in comparison to the European Union. And Canada, for example, we don't even see density matrix formalism in our courses typically, right? It might be mentioned in an advanced course, but it wouldn't be mentioned in, you know, a first-year graduate course. We also know at the same time that we have this burgeoning field of physics education research where there is hard data for students improving in their ability to learn physics and use it in a professional way when you change teaching methods. Very hard data, lots of it. And I'll just give you one example, okay? So there's been this enormous success, but the success has been in first and second year classes, and physicists, I'm one of them and I'm arrogant, so I'm happy to say physicists are arrogant. You know, they like to say, no offense, they like to say, you know, oh, well, you know, those methods are fine for the life science students and the engineering students, right? They need that, but we don't need those changes, right? So it's fine for physics one and two, but let's not use these crazy physics education methods in anything else. You know, can these methods be extended into the regular physics curriculum, and can we take advantage of these teaching improvements that have been happening in so many fields other than physics? Okay, one of the first pieces of evidence, and this was done by my collaborator from PER, is that unfortunately, in junior level quantum mechanics classes, we can show with a pretest and a post-test that students already are not learning what they're supposed to learn. So, you know, we think they're learning the Schrodinger equation. We think they're learning that, you know, a wave function is a probability distribution. A lot of times they don't even really know what a wave is, I'm sorry to say. So, you know, the reality is, you know, when you get down and test, you quickly find out that there's a lot of problems that need fixing. So I think it's important when teaching a class to ask yourself early on, what's my goal in the class? Okay? So, and I think there are four major areas that you can think about when you design your curriculum and design your course. So the first one is content. And so everybody's familiar with content, okay? And I can divide the taking in of content in a student into two categories, novice and expert. So the novice, you know, uses formulas and does plug and chug, as we call it, right? Everybody has students who do that in Physics 1. I hope nobody here is still doing that. Maybe they are. If so, please stop, okay? you know, and the expert, it learns how to use concepts and problem-solving techniques and really solve any problems, whether or not they have a formula. Right? Isn't that the goal? Isn't that the goal for professional physicists? Okay, and we can think about structure. You know, students at first see physics in little pieces, and by the time, do you have qualifying exams here? Yes? No, you don't. Okay. So one of the goals of qualifying exams, other than, you know, making students miserable, is to actually help them put the various areas of physics together. So this goal of coherence, you know, it has to be realized one way or another. Yeah. So, you know, if you see quantum mechanics and classical mechanics and electromagnetism and thermodynamics as separate topics, then you haven't really become a physicist yet. These need to come together. Okay. Of course, physics is not about, you know, ex cathedra proclamations by the great authorities, but physics is, in fact, about doing independent work, in particular experiments, and, you know, repeating the experiment and making sure it's right and testing things for yourself. That's what an expert does. And then finally, something we forget about as physicists, but is in fact extremely important, the students sitting in this room know this, and the professors, if they can think back to when they were students, can think this is so important, is that, you know, you should go from, we hope, drudgery to joy as you become an expert. Okay? If you stay in the drudgery realm, you're not going to be a professional physicist, or you'll be a very unhappy one. Okay, so, you know, happiness is important. No, I'm serious. I mean, you know, you'll do better research if you enjoy what you're doing, right? Okay, so these four areas are very important. We want to teach, you know, people to think like a scientist, and if we want to teach people to think about science like a scientist, why shouldn't we put in the time as faculty to think about education like a scientist? Okay, right. So this is adapted from another person's ideas. I'm simply presenting general ideas from physics education research here, and let me give you a sense of what goes on in this field. So first of all, there's a lot of data that we're missing in our classes. I mean, imagine you do an experiment, you know, and you make a density measurement. Well, why aren't you looking at density-density correlations? You know, why don't you look at something higher order in the experiment? Maybe that's actually sitting in your computer and you already took the data for your experiment. You need to go back and analyze it and pull out all that useful information. It's the same idea in PER. We have a whole bunch of useful information sitting around, and one of the things that we can extract from that is that, unfortunately, not only do students not learn what we believe them to, but they learn some things that we don't expect them to learn. Okay? Like if I just use a formula, I'll get an A. Right? Okay, we hope they don't learn that. So there's a subfield of physics education research which has been looking at really specific ways to fix these things. And that's mainly what I'm going to talk about today. In fact, what I'm talking about today is a very applied version of physics education research. And we'll talk about tools for assessment. I'm not going to talk about models of student learning, although this is a major topic in physics education. It's a kind of a social science topic, a cognitive science topic mixed, and it's a great subject. And I'll talk about different suggestions for new approaches in class. Okay, here's some hard data. This is just one piece I give you, but I think it's absolutely overwhelming data. So if we look at this data, you know, in a traditional lecture, which is what I'm doing, of course, today, as I was telling someone earlier, if I actually used the techniques that I used in my graduate quantum course, I'd probably frighten you all and you'd run off, you know. So when I teach these classes, I go and I sit in the middle of the class and we break up into groups. And, I mean, it's totally different from this strategy. So I apologize for using traditional techniques, but this being colloquial, I didn't want to be too radical. So for traditional lectures, you find out that if you look at the post versus pretest gain, okay, the learning gain is about 25% for a traditional method. Traditional method is exactly what I'm doing now, where you sit there and you listen and I tell you what it's all about, okay? Hopefully you're thinking for yourselves. Now, it turns out that if you make almost any kind of change, this improves. Okay? Almost any kind of change. I mean, you know, you can do tutorials, you can do clickers, you can do partially Socratic method, you can just, you know, go sit down with the students, you know, you can every 10 minutes have a long pause. Almost anything you can do improves on the standard physics technique of teaching. I'm sorry to say. And so this is a survey of 6,000 students, you know, many different courses, many different universities. This is all of Physics 1, okay? And the particular measurement tool, the assessment tool, is called the Force Concept Inventory. How many people have heard of this? A lot of people. Okay, so this is just, you know, it's a standardized test that allows you to determine, you know, how much people have learned in Physics 1. Okay. So this is really, I think, a very impressive hard data. And, you know, I could present tons of this. I'm not. I'm just going to show you one plot. It's not my area. So let me now mention about the traditional model of education. So the model of education is like this. You know, I have some content, you know, let's say, I don't know, the Dyson series or, you know, whatever. And now I'm going to talk to you and transmit it to you, and then you as the individual will take it into your heads. So we have a picture to illustrate this method. So this is the picture. Okay? You know, so is there something else that we could be doing, right? Okay. You know, it might be that the classroom, it's interesting that this is that kind of classroom. I've also taught in this sort of classroom. It might be that the classroom actually builds in this method. So one thing that it turns out you can do is to break people up into groups and have tables and whatnot, and that's part of the studio method of teaching. So now I mentioned earlier all this work in PER, in physics education research, in lower division. It turns out that's already very well established with hard data. Okay, now people are extending this into upper division classes at the undergraduate level, and here's some of the institutions involved. I'm doing a study of classical mechanics now, and many people are doing studies of different courses. But, you know, my idea when I started this study, oh, by the way, you know, being a theorist, you know, in theory, it's very possible to have an idea and, you know, like do the calculations and write the paper and have it done in 3 months. Like, never happens in an experiment, right? But, you know, in theory, that happens. Well, physics education research is very much like experimental work. I mean, it's years to get all the data and put it all together and understand it. So this was like a 3-year study. So actually, none of this stuff had really started. Most of it had not started when I started the study. So I just thought to myself, well, forget about upper division. Let's just go right to graduate courses. Let's go to graduate quantum mechanics, considered one of the toughest classes, and see what we can do with it. Okay. So let me tell you now about my strategy for reform in graduate quantum mechanics. Before I start that, I'm concerned that, you know, you may not have had a lot of physics education research talks. This might be very unfamiliar to people in the audience. Is there anything you want to ask me about PR in general? I'm happy to take questions now before I delve into my stuff. No, everyone's totally convinced, and they're all going to... You have about one per year. I see. Okay, so I'm the one per year guy. Great. Okay. Glad to know what I'm doing is relevant. Okay. So here's my strategy for reform. I first taught a benchmark course, and this was a totally standard course. In fact, I didn't even write my own notes. I used the notes that were very well established at the University of Colorado, a very large university. It had been used for 10 years. These were notes that were developed by several faculty. So everybody was in agreement. This is how the class should be taught. Okay, so it's not, you know, the benchmark was not me. The benchmark, although of course I was doing the instructing, the material, the benchmark was very much, you know, a well-accepted large course. Okay, so in the first year I taught a benchmark course. So that's my control. Now let me mention that, you know, when you do physics education research, you know, this is much more like social science and your control is not really much of a control. Because, you know, I'm doing the experiment and I'm also in the experiment. That's bad, right? Okay, but there's really no way to get around that, unfortunately, at least in the early stages. So at least I have something of a control. That's this benchmark. And then I went on and taught two different new courses where I incorporated the best material from the previous course where the best material was determined by the students, by their comments in evaluations. Okay, and then I applied the same assessment tools, seven different forms of evaluation. So how many forms of evaluation do you do here? Is it one? It's bubble forms or something, right? Is that what you do? For graduate courses, you have no evaluations? No evaluations. Okay. So, no, you have some. Apparently, some people use them and some people don't. Okay. I see how it is here. Okay. So, anyway, so we have seven forms of evaluation. So, as a faculty member sitting in the audience, you might be thinking, well, that's nice for, you know, Lincoln Carr there, but I'll bet he puts 50% of his time into teaching. I'm never going to do that because I want to get my research done. I didn't. And that's one of the things I'm going to tell you about, that you don't have to put in a lot more time to do all these forms of evaluation. Okay? All right. So don't be scared. Okay. And then I gradually increased the use of these tested PER techniques. When I say they're tested, I mean they're tested at the undergraduate level, particularly for first and second year classes. There was no evidence before I did this study that these techniques were at all useful in graduate classes. And let me say that, in fact, people were very scared in my university that I would incorporate such things into graduate courses. Maybe I would, you know, break a whole class of graduate students and they wouldn't know quantum mechanics. So, you know, one of the things that I did was to get agreement among all the faculty about having a lot of discussion before I did that. I think that's very important. If you want to change how a course is taught, it has to be something the faculty agree on. Yes?
Could you just tell us what the population of your benchmark course was?
I will, yes. No problem. Not much. I don't have a lot of data. I wish I had more, but, you know, I'm at a small technical school. We have 600 graduate students, 3,000 undergraduates, and it's all science and engineering. So it's not the same environment as University of Toronto. So please keep that in mind. And that's part of the systematics of the study. So again, being a scientist, I can use my scientific training, even in this kind of social science area, and I want to look at what my systematics are. So first of all, you know, it's a very application-oriented university, you know, earth, energy, environment. We have a joint institute with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in the United States. Almost everything we do has something to do with energy, renewables, non-renewable, but mainly renewable. We have a lot of non-traditional students in our program. That's a special aspect of our program. These are students with families, students who come out of the military and whatnot, with a lot of military bases nearby. In the first semester, I have half master's students. And I certainly take their point of view into account, but they don't actually factor into the data that I'll show you. So the data applies only to the PhD students, and that's really about 10 students per year. So we're talking a sample of 30 students over 3 years. It's not a lot. I wish I had more. If I was teaching here, I would. But at a small university, I don't. This is what I have to work with. And that's one of the things that needs to be done, is to replicate the results of this. Maybe somebody here will do that. I would love to collaborate with anybody who's interested. So it'd be interesting to replicate the results in a larger class in a different kind of university, different systematics. You know, because I'm also in the experiment, I have to mention my own systematics. Although I've taught many times, this is my first time teaching this particular course. I'm a researcher in quantum many-body theory. Obviously, that influences my point of view on quantum mechanics. For example, I think quantum mechanics is the coolest thing there is, right? So, I'm an assistant professor, so I'm earlier on in my career. And then my sort of bubble form evaluations are about average for the department, so I represent, in some sense, the average instructor. I'm not the guy that everybody wants to take a class from. I'm also not the guy that nobody wants to take a class with, okay? So I'm about in the middle, just to be honest. Okay, so these are the systematics for the study. Okay, so let's go through the textbook. So you remember I have four areas, right? I'm going to go through textbook, content, teaching methods, and then assessment tools. So let's go through the textbook first. Now, in order to do this study, I went through over 50 textbooks. I divide them into three categories. One category is the classics that typically deal with periods 1 and 2. For example, Landau-Lifschitz deals with periods 1 and 2 mainly, although there's a bit of density matrix in there. Would you agree, John, that it's mainly periods 1 and 2? I love Landau-Lifschitz, so please don't get me wrong. I have the entire series on my shelf and read them all the time. But anyway, it's a little bit dated now. Okay, and then the second category, there are a lot of wonderful books that are very specialized. So, for example, Asher Perez has a wonderful book on foundational quantum mechanics and quantum measurement theory, which I recommend to any person here, graduate student or faculty. Cohen Tanuji, I consider that to be a pretty applied book towards AMO. Levi is another author that does some kind of solid state applications. And then there's this third category. And these are books you're probably not familiar with because they're all, you know, post the measurement of Bell's inequalities. You know, they're typically late 90s, early part of, so like 2000 to 2005. And so one nice example is Padevant d'Alibar. Another one is Ray. Gottfried and Yen actually have an old book, but they did a new edition, which really does change the whole way they present quantum mechanics. So there are lots of new books to choose from. So I chose three, and the choice was somewhat arbitrary. I could have chosen other ones. I chose Sakurai as the benchmark because I myself went through that course, so I thought I could understand it well from the point of view of a student. In the second year, I chose something from the French system. Intentionally, I wanted to choose something from Europe. That's Le Bellec. And in the third year, I chose something from the U.S. system. So you have to look out for an educational mismatch. For example, my understanding is that at Toronto, you take much more advanced courses as undergraduates than we typically do in the U.S. Okay, and certainly that's also the case in France. So Le Bellec is somehow supposed to represent that. Okay, and now I'm going to go through these three textbooks one by one. So let's evaluate each book. Now, when I make these statements, none of these statements are my opinion. My opinion may not agree with these statements. These statements are made based on the evaluations, okay, and what students had to say through these seven assessment methods, which I'll tell you at the end. Okay, so just to clarify where these things come from. So don't get mad at me if you don't agree with something. Get mad at my students. They're safely far away. Okay? So first thing is that people felt that Sakurai has excellent pedagogy. Students find it very readable, particularly the first two chapters, which, of course, were written by Sakurai. I guess you all know that a colleague of his followed up after he passed away, so the latter half of the book is written by somebody else. Sakurai has numerous physical examples that people like. It doesn't start with a review or historical perspective, so Sakurai has the idea that if you want to swim, we'll just, you know, throw you into the Pacific Ocean and good luck, okay? I happen to like that method. Students also seem to like this. They don't seem to like learning about history, maybe because they're scientists. You know, I'm just being honest. Okay, and the other thing is students like that approximation methods are in terms of applications. Yeah, so it doesn't just look like a bunch of math methods. The weaknesses are Sakurai really covers only periods 1 and 2 of quantum mechanics. Angular momentum, which is not a major topic in quantum theory today, is actually 1/3 of the entire text. Okay, so there's an imbalance, and there's a misleading treatment of mixed states, and it's not that students commented that that there was a misleading treatment. How could they know, right? It's that I can tell from how they can do on problems involving mixed states that, does everyone know what a mixed state is? That's like if you, so sorry, I'll throw out some stuff in quantum mechanics, which the whole audience may not know. So just to clarify, mixed states refers to the idea, so in quantum mechanics, you have two levels of uncertainty. One is the uncertainty of the wave function, okay? And the other is uncertainty due to lack of information. So, for example, I might have a big quantum system and I make a measurement on only one part, right? And that can be entangled with the other part. It means that I don't get all the information from making this measurement. I would call that piece of the system a mixed state with respect to the whole system. Does that make sense? A sort of lack of information, if you will. It also involves finite temperature, which is how Sakurai presents that. And so the way I can tell these things is, you know, students understand mixed states in the second and third year, and they don't understand in the first year, okay, on these assessments. Okay. Now let's go on to the second textbook. In the second year, I used a book by Le Bellec. This is a French text. And I think for French people, this is an undergraduate text. So it would be, so you might use an undergraduate course here. For us, it was a graduate course, although I had to slightly supplement it with path integration, but basically it's a graduate course. So Le Bellec's book is called Quantum Physics. I recommend it, by the way. I think it's a very nice book. The students found it somewhat readable. They liked that there were many physical examples. Le Bellec has an entire chapter just on applications of quantum mechanics in many different fields. Entanglement is seamlessly integrated with the whole book, so all of my students that came out of that class understood what entanglement was and did not find it a confusing concept in the slightest, which is better than, you know, most of my colleagues, so, you know, probably including myself. And then, you know, there's a clear statement of the postulates of quantum mechanics, right? And you might be saying to yourself, what postulates if you took Sakurai, right? Because there are no postulates in Sakurai. Oh, I thought quantum mechanics was like a toolbox, right? And I have a wrench and, you know, I have a screwdriver and, you know, and that's it, right? No, I mean, quantum mechanics can be stated as an axiomatic theory, just like the theory of special relativity, okay? And in modern treatments of quantum mechanics, you find a clear statement of postulates. Now, people like John may decide there should be more or less postulates, but let's say overall we agree there are some postulates. Okay, yes? This is graduate quantum mechanics I'm talking about. Oh, an undergraduate course. Since I did this study, now they don't know what the hell to use. So, I mean, they're completely changing their mind every single time. So before they used this book with the cat on the cover, you know this one by Griffiths? Yep. So, and that's pretty typical in U.S. educational system. Quantum mechanics will be taught in the junior year out of a book like Griffiths. Now they're thinking that they don't want to use Griffiths, and they even tried a sort of, you know, French undergraduate text, which looks like a U.S. graduate text. That didn't go too well. There's now debate about what should be used. And finally, the whole community in Colorado, so we have a big higher education community there involving several universities, has gotten involved with quantum mechanics reform at the undergraduate level, and this has been part of the reason for that. For sure. To give you an example of how different the U.S. system is, you know, at JILA, which is one of the top institutes in the country for AMO physics, they use Cohen Tanuji for a graduate course, which I would personally never do. Yeah, I know, you the shock on your face, but I mean, that's where the U.S. system is at, you know. Somehow, you know, U.S. students make it up by the end of their graduate career. Maybe that's why they're in graduate school for like 6.5 years, right? I don't know. How long do you guys stay in graduate? 6.5. Okay. Yeah. Well, I was hoping we could shorten it, but all right. Okay. Good. So let's come to the weaknesses. One of the weaknesses is what we were just discussing, that there's a real mismatch between the European and I suppose Canadian system, although I'm really only familiar with Toronto. I haven't been to other Canadian universities, so I don't know if this is, you know, widespread in Canada, but I've lived in the EU and, you know, traveled all over, and you know, certainly there's a big educational mismatch, particularly in mathematics. So that's one big issue. And this was a weakness that just came out over and over in this text. Even though it's supposedly, you know, undergraduate level in France, it's still hard for our graduate students, the math, okay? You know, like they talk about formal aspects of Hilbert spaces. You know, students have no idea what these formal mathematical words mean. They haven't even ever had an upper division undergraduate math course. So, the scattering theory and perturbation theory were a bit low level. I had to supplement them to bring them up to appropriate graduate level. There's no path integration, so I had to add that. And then there's I personally think path integration is important in a quantum mechanics class. And then there's a kind of a spiral teaching method where you come back to the same topic three times. I thought that was a great idea. My students hated it, and complained endlessly about it. So the reason they complain is because, you know, physics students really like to see rigorous, you know, statements from the beginning. They don't want to hear a half truth and then a three-quarter truth and then the whole truth. It makes them very mad, okay? So you know, that was considered a weakness by the students. And then finally, I come to Gottfried and Jahn. Let me clarify that in a way, this is the most impressive book because the first edition, you know, came out a long time ago. I mean, it's hard to even find. Yeah, it's certainly out of print. And this first edition, you know, really only covered periods 1 and 2 of quantum mechanics. But these same authors, who are, you know, quite senior now, actually went and learned all of periods 3 and 4 of quantum mechanics. You know, and they're particle theorists. They didn't necessarily have to do that, but they chose to do that and wrote an absolutely spectacular second edition that incorporates these new periods. So I recommend this book actually to the professionals in the audience. I think it's great reading and a great resource. Maybe it's not Jackson, but it's something like that, like something you can keep on your shelf. So this book teaches modern quantum mechanics through all stages 1 through 4 from the very beginning. For example, you see pure and mixed states basically from day one, you know, page one in the book. It's very rigorous and careful on all points, so me as a theorist, I loved it. It turns out, you know, the students also liked it, and it's quite broad in what it covers. You know, you see quantum fluctuations, you see the Wigner theorem, et cetera. These are not things you're going to see in Sakurai. Okay, weaknesses. You can tell it's written by theorists because there are no physical examples till chapter 4, page 165. And the students are really mad about that. Okay, the chapter 1 on fundamental concepts, you know, students can't understand what the fundamental concepts of quantum mechanics are before they learn what quantum mechanics is, right? So how can you put that in chapter 1? So the idea is that it should be a sort of historical chapter, but because it's a historical chapter that goes through all 4 periods of quantum mechanics, including like measurements of Bell's inequalities, students just got nothing out of that chapter. So maybe the course could be taught again where this chapter was taught like last. It might work. Again, there was a spiral method of teaching, although it wasn't as extreme at Leblanc, but I simply didn't have time to follow it because this is a very, very thick text. So it's an overcomplete text, and that can be good if you want to take a subset of material, but it can be bad if the material is repeated in different ways. And sometimes, because these are theorists and, you know, they like to be special, like, you know, I like to be special, they have some kind of atypical treatment of topics like degenerate perturbation theory. It's sort of putting their stamp on theory. It's a typical thing theorists do. Nobody left, so I guess you all are just used to it. But that's what they do, theorists, you know. Like, they get into notation and et cetera. So the theorists in the audience hopefully are smiling. Okay. So, all right. So let's go on to talk about the content in the course. So my starting premise was that I had to integrate the second half of quantum mechanics, the last 40 years. Okay, where the so-called philosophy of quantum mechanics becomes experimentally accessible, leading to things like quantum computers. Okay, so I had to integrate that material in the course. Well, you know, the other driving factor is, especially at a smaller university where, you know, we're going to accept, let's say, you know, 12 students per year or 10 students per year, and they're going to go into very particular groups, is what do these students need to get their research done? It's not like I'm educating the general student who might do one of 100 things. Instead, our university focuses in some very specific areas. So I targeted my physical examples in the class towards these areas: condensed matter, optics, and nuclear physics. We have a huge renewable energy program, and then theoretical and computational physics. So, like, you know, you don't see high energy physics in there, right? You know, we have a token string theorist, but we don't really have a string theory group or anything. I thought you'd enjoy that. So, okay. So now, for example, quantum mechanics can often be taught as basically a class in AMO applications, and you see that in Cohen and Tanucci. I mean, I believe that's a totally wrong approach to quantum mechanics, and I tried to get completely away from that. Okay. So obviously to do this, you know, you have to cut some things, right? You want to add another 40 years of quantum mechanics in, what are you going to take out of the first 40 years? Uh-oh. So let's find out what I cut. Let me say again, in terms of faculty buy-in, the faculty agreed on what I would cut ahead of time. I didn't tell them afterwards, by the way, I didn't teach your students this thing you need to get research done. Sorry, you know, you can't do that, okay? You have to have people agree ahead of time. Okay, so let me tell you first what I cut, and so you can feel the pain first. So the first thing I did is I cut the full-blown treatment of the Wigner-Eckhart theorem, okay, which, you know, is pretty serious. That's a really important theorem. So instead of doing it in terms of, you know, irreducible tensor operators, I just did a vector version of it, okay? Very simple version of it. I cut a lot of scattering theory, you know, which would make high energy theorists probably really unhappy, right? And some scattering applications. I cut any kind of review of undergraduate quantum mechanics, okay? So, you know, I just threw students in, and I didn't go back and go over wave functions. I know Sakurai doesn't do that, but a lot of books do that, okay? I cut some of this AMO stuff that's very typical in these classes. Okay, so everyone knows what Clebsch-Gordan coefficients are. It's how you add 1 plus 1 to get 2 in spin space, basically, right? Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. So how do you put two objects together that have rotational degrees of freedom, put them together to get a composite object? What are the rotations, you know, rotational states of the composite object? That's the basic idea. And, you know, the whole formalism is quite large. But these days, you know, you can just, as I was mentioning, David, over lunch, you can just type Clebsch-Gordan into Mathematica, and voila, it gives you a number, right? So the question is, you know, how much Clebsch-Gordan should you teach? Do students have to be able to do, you know, spin 37 plus, you know, spin 93 halves? No, right? They don't need to do that today. So you can do a reduced version of Clebsch-Gordan, but still teach it. I cut more scattering even, and then I dropped any kind of mathematical physics review that wasn't covered already in that was already covered in math physics classes that are required. So, for example, in Sakurai, you find a, you know, I don't know, 30 pages on classical rotations. I didn't cover classical rotations. Okay, that's what I cut. So now let's see if I gain something. Here's what I put in. So first thing is I put in the postulates of quantum mechanics. It's a radical idea, but, you know, you could actually have postulates, and quantum mechanics might actually be, you know, a together theory, not just a toolbox. I put in density matrix formalism, partial traces, and entanglement from the beginning. As I mentioned, entanglement, if you don't already know, I know people who grew up with quantum mechanics period 1 and 2, entanglement can seem quite mysterious. It's just the idea that things are interconnected. We all know that on a fundamental level, in a philosophical sense. And again, you know, it's the idea that if I have a system and I make a measurement on one part, do I have all the information, or do I also have to measure the other part? It's basically the idea of entanglement, at least qualitatively. I put in some baby quantum field theory, so that's just quantum field theory in 1D, which you can do a pretty straightforward way. In fact, John, you recommended that I do that when I spoke to you before I taught these classes. I put in quantum fluctuations. I put in the Wigner theorem and more advanced treatment of symmetries. In the second year, I put in polarization states, doing light as an example of another spin one-half system. Does everyone know that spin one-half is the same as a qubit? Any two-state system is a qubit, right? This didn't work out so well. Students had trouble visualizing this kind of stuff. The reason is because they actually don't know optics, which I discovered. So, I mean, I just didn't know that. Okay. I tried putting in unbounded operators in a formal treatment of infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, total disaster, at least in the US. And then I put in a much broader series of applications in terms of nuclear physics, optics, and solid state, which are strong emphases at my particular institution. I'm not saying everybody should do this. So let me tell you what the final syllabus looks like. And I'll just go through the syllabus pretty quick, and then we can go on to the teaching techniques, which I think can interest people more who aren't into quantum mechanics. But I thought since, you know, most professional physicists certainly took quantum mechanics and probably used quantum mechanics at some point, at least in teaching, if not in research, it'd be interesting for you to see, I thought, what the actual syllabus was. So remember, it's a two-semester graduate class, and the assumption is that students already took quantum mechanics as undergraduates, so they knew a certain amount before they came in. So first, three lectures per week, each of an hour in the first semester. Second semester is typically two lectures per week, hour and a half. So same amount of time, but split up slightly differently.
So roughly how many lectures?
I believe I can tell you precisely. So it's 16 times 3, if you can calculate that. Okay, so 16-week semester, and then three lectures per week. Sorry, in the U.S. we actually occasionally get a vacation, like one per year, you know, at one day. So sort of a joke about the U.S., but only French people would find that funny. Okay, so I guess, is Canada just as bad? It seems so civilized here. Okay, well, there might be like one of those days off, but basically, so 16 times 3 minus a day or two. So we start off with a full immersion, doing Stern-Gerlach experiments, something about qubits, something about polarization states, depending on the year, and then dive right into the formal framework of quantum mechanics, where I state the postulates of quantum mechanics, where I talk about connections between quantum mechanics and classical mechanics. That's the idea of integration. Instead of having pieces, you have coherence, right? I talk about, you know, things like entropy and the uncertainty principle. All of this comes in right at the beginning. By the way, this can all be done with a single qubit, maybe two qubits. You really don't have to go to, in infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces or large dimensional Hilbert spaces to do this. And in fact, in engineering departments today, in many places around the world, if you take a quantum course and it's geared towards, so we call it EECS, electrical engineering and computer science, typically they'll stay with just the qubit or two qubits, and that's how they'll introduce quantum mechanics, to teach people about quantum computing. Okay, and then the next part is symmetries and conservation laws. Some vector and tensor operators I did only in the first year. Some basic applications, for example, doing benzene, NMR, a little solid state. These things are quite useful for people. And then some angular momentum, but this is much reduced over what you're used to from Sakurai. Then basic approximation methods. And in the second year, I did the harmonic oscillator. In the third year, I put it into the second semester. Okay, so now the second semester is only for PhD students. The master students don't take the second semester, so the mathematics gets more sophisticated. That's why we put propagators and path integration in the second semester. It's not really appropriate for master students doing a terminal master's degree. We do a harmonic oscillator, and that, of course, leads right into baby quantum field theory because you have destruction and creation operators and whatnot. So we do some gauge transforms, RNF Bohm, okay? Students very often ask this, the Schrodinger equation has mass in it, so, what do you do with a massless particle? Is there no quantum mechanics, right? So, here's a way to start bringing the vector field and electromagnetism into quantum mechanics in a small way, and then in the context of the quantum fluctuations, we also do it. So they see electromagnetism in quantum mechanics a couple of times. I think that helps because, at least the way I took the class, it was very much oriented towards massive particles. And when I went on to, work in professional quantum mechanics, you have to know about what happens when you have a massless particle and it has some quantum aspect to it. WKB is a semi-classical approximation method that shifted around depending on the year. And then I do some more typical topics like hydrogenic atoms, some advanced applications of time-dependent perturbation theory like photoelectric effect. And then finally, I get to a real sophisticated treatment of symmetry, much better treatment than I had. I only got this treatment when I took like a group theory course. Okay, so now instead of having a separate group theory course, it appears at least partially in a quantum mechanics class. Do you require group theory here? No, but you require quantum mechanics, right? Of course, as a physicist, you're really going to have trouble succeeding if you have no idea what SUN means, right? So it's really important that this appear in a required class. Okay, and then scattering theory, a reduced version, but still, Lippmann-Schwinger equation and cross-sections and TNS matrices and whatnot. Okay. So for those of you who, you know, haven't done quantum mechanics for a long time or don't find quantum mechanics that exciting, let me go on to the third topic, because this third topic is really not about quantum mechanics. It's about, you know, taking these teaching methods from first and second year classes and incorporating them into graduate school, right? And the first question you should always ask, by the way, with new teaching methods is, you know, did you do any worse? Right? You know, did the student's ability to, you know, do quantum mechanics go down? Right? And if you haven't broken anything, you're already doing pretty good. Because, you know, when you start messing around with teaching techniques that have been established for a long time, you know, you can worry. You can worry that, you know, students are not going to succeed. They won't know what they need to know. They'll waste the whole year. They'll hate the program and drop out. I mean, anything can happen. Right? Okay. So let me say that students certainly didn't get any worse. Let's see how much better they got. So here's the methods. All right. So I'm going to try to fold in some PER techniques, okay, into graduate instruction. And at this time, this had never been done. This is now 3.5 years ago. So the first thing is, so, you know, used to the Calvin version, you know, where I take off your head and I put the knowledge in and I put the head back on, or with the skull cap. You saw that, right? The picture. Okay, so that's called, you know, instructor to student. All right, and that's what I'm doing now. Okay. So student to instructor is where, you know, I ask a question and the student responds, something we do very often in classes. And it can also be where students, you know, volunteer or ask their own questions, right? So some people have already been doing that. And, you know, if you just wait for people to ask questions, you're only going to have the noisy people interact, right? I mean, I'm a noisy person. I was always asking questions in class. But there were plenty of people who had better questions than mine. They just never spoke up. So, you know, with 10 or 20 students, I could elicit a response from every single student in every lecture. So that's the first thing I did. Every single student spoke up in every lecture. Okay, and there was a small amount of credit associated with participation, which encouraged that, 5% of the grade. Okay, and it also meant that students never ever missed a class, whether from fear or excitement, I don't know, but okay. Now, the next kind of interaction you can incorporate in the classroom, and this is something that we usually don't do in physics but is often done in other disciplines, is student-to-student interaction. So right now, you know, I might ask you a question, and you would respond. Let's see, you. Right? What's your name?
Jasper.
So I might ask you a question, Jasper, and you would respond to me. We would have some kind of personal contact, and you would feel like you're a part of the class. But, you know, me teaching you is me having done physics for, 20, I won't say how many years now, you know, and then trying to go back into your mind where you're at now. I don't know what level you're at. Are you a graduate student or? Master student. Okay, so you're like a year or two past your undergraduate, and you know you're taking in a lot of these subjects in physics for the first time at the graduate level, and so you know my way of understanding may be very different from yours, right? And I might have forgotten how you take things in. So maybe I could turn to your colleague. So what's your name?
Hyo.
Okay, I could turn to your colleague and ask the two of you to have a conversation about some subject, let's say entanglement, right? And in fact, I might even pose a problem by writing it on the board, and have everybody break up into small groups. Discuss it amongst themselves, write their answers on the board so they're committed to it, and in my room I had boards all the way around, and then we come back together and discuss. Now, as a person, you know, teaching a graduate course, you might say, oh my gosh, I'm going to lose 50% of the material. I can't give up 10 minutes of class time to have my students talk to each other. No way, right? You might say that to yourself. But what you can show is that this actually increases their ability to take in the material that you do teach. Yeah. Sometimes. The question is, do they actually do it? Do they actually do it? I'll talk about that in a minute, but that's important. You can do tutorials, you know, which is a sort of a separate, you guys do that here sometimes. We have like a separate section where, you know, people sit around and talk to each other. But you can incorporate this into the classroom without sacrificing the class. Okay. So anyway, at least I tried it. Okay. You know, they've done a lot of studies of students reading textbooks, and it turns out about a third of students, more or less, actually look at a textbook before they ever come to lecture. And then if you ask how many students ever read the textbook in detail, it's something like half. I mean, it's an abysmal number, I'm afraid to say. Now, us as, you know, physics faculty, we're probably the people who read the textbook. So, you know, it's sort of hard to look back and think about the diversity of a class. But, you know, even at the graduate level, about half of people actually finish their PhDs. You know, and of those, I believe it's about a quarter going to academia. So if you're sitting with, you know, 80 students, let's say, in a graduate course, 10 of them are actually going to become faculty members somewhere. That's including liberal arts and the whole thing, right? So 70 out of those 80 are going to go do something else, whether it's government, industry, or failing out, or whatever, right? So I think it's important to recognize that when you teach a class. Did I answer your question? Yeah. Okay. So these are things that can happen. And even if I was to ask a question, for example, of Jasper, just because you're the only person's name I know other than, you know, John Sipe and a few other faculty, I'm going to keep picking on you, Jasper. So you know, I might ask Jasper, you know, a question. He answers me, and then I can say, how did you know that was true? Right? And then he would explain that to the class. That's another way to get student-to-student interaction, where he's not explaining it to me, but he's explaining it to the class. Okay? And then I can use clickers. Does anybody here ever use clickers? Raise your hand if you use clickers. A few faculty and no students. That's really strange. Do you teach classes just to the faculty, or? Okay, so the idea of a clicker is, you know, you put up a question, a provocative question, you know, with multiple choice answers, and then you have students commit to an answer with a little electronic device, and their answer is recorded in an impersonal way. Although maybe what the faculty don't tell the students is that in fact there's an ID on every clicker, so it is sort of a personal way. But hopefully we don't look at these IDs. Well, that was the guy that always got the wrong answer. F, you know, no. So the idea is with the clicker, you know, you get to engage. Everybody gets to sort of vote on something. And then the important thing with clickers is to discuss the wrong answers as well as the right answers. Why are the wrong answers wrong? Okay, that's what a lot of the research says that you have to do. Because of my small class size, people could just use their fingers, put it up on their chest so people can't see, and we just do a vote. Right? I don't have to use this electronic device and make them pay $60 for this thing. Okay, and then another significant change I made, and this I recommend for any class, I think it absolutely should be part of every class, is to have a major focus on concepts. So we focus on calculations, 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 right? Everybody go through classes like that? That's what I went through, right? And that's great, and you're supposed to go home, you know, read your textbook, think about the concepts and figure it out for yourself. Well, how come we're not talking about concepts in the classroom? Now, maybe some of you are, but a lot of people don't. So what I did is actually had a 25% conceptual component to every exam. And then students are definitely going to think about concepts, right? Because they want to pass. Okay. An example of concepts?
No, an exam question with conceptual
content. Oh, sure. Explain what entanglement means and how you would measure it. There's a typical kind of question. When is perturbation theory relevant? Something like that. Okay, so they're the kind of things that are going to help a student become, you know, an expert who can use physics rather than, you know, having these pieces in which they put formulas in and they know how to calculate that kind of problem and that kind of problem and that kind of problem. And it's what we naturally do anyway at conferences, right? I mean, all of us that go to conferences, that's the kind of thing we start doing there, right, in our individual conversations. But why can't we incorporate that in the classroom? I mean, well, how does that take away from the class? It can't, right? It must only add. So, okay, other additions I made, which were more or less successful depending on how I did them. As I mentioned, I used a partial Socratic method where I would actually sit down in the middle of the lecture. So, for example, you know, I would come up and sit down and turn to somebody and then, you know, have a discussion with that person, you know, so I become part of the class. That's another thing you can do. It also breaks up the, you know, monotony of a physics professor droning away. And Socratic method means that, for example, I could pose a problem and then simply ask people about where I might go in the class with it. So instead of, you know, doing a proof and saying, this is how it is, you know, I am the authority, I am the Pope, okay, no offense to anybody Catholic, I'm just saying, you know, to say that, you know, it's infallibility, right? You know, you pose something up there, and then at some point, you know, students start realizing that, hey, I can be a physicist too, and I can start thinking about this now. I don't have to wait until I have a PhD, okay? I provided all notes online in advance. I provided open questions to guide thinking in the notes. So in the notes, there are questions posed that are not answered. Now that, I don't know your name, sir, but you asked about reading the textbook ahead of time. Part of what made students read the notes was this open questions issue. Okay? I got students to predict the lecture, as I just mentioned, and finally there's this rule where you should have long pauses. So I don't know how it is in Canada, but in the U.S. we have an attention span of about 10 minutes. Nobody left, so maybe it's true here too. So after about 10 minutes, people start to zone out, basically. So there's this kind of 10-2 rule. Where out of every 10 minutes, you know, you spend 2 minutes just pausing to give people time to think. I think if we followed this in our presentations at professional conferences, things would go much better, actually. Yeah. Okay. And then finally, I'm going to come to the assessment tools. Now, it's 5 o'clock. Can I go for another 5 minutes? I'm sorry, I was a little bit slow at first. I was having too much fun. Now I'll just speed up and do more material. No, just kidding. Okay, so, okay. So suppose that, you know, you want to evaluate all these things. There are 7 things that I did. So first thing is an undergraduate conceptual survey. This is a well-developed tool from physics education research developed by my collaborator. And that's the reason that Sam, as she calls herself, was my collaborator, okay? I also developed a new survey called the Graduate Quantum Mechanics Conceptual Survey, okay? That's to test graduate concepts. I would claim that undergraduate and graduate concepts in classical mechanics, in quantum mechanics, are somewhat distinct. That's not something I thought before I did this study, something I thought after. I have these bubble forms, which I guess you guys have here, at least for undergraduates. I have students do self-evaluations of me. That is to say, I have my own evaluation that I provide for them, and then they write a sort of essay form, like, what were three strengths of the problem sets? What were three weaknesses? How would you improve the exams? You know, how did you feel about this class? Things like that, that you just don't get on a bubble form, okay? This is no extra work, this kind of thing, right? At the end of the third week of classes, I interviewed every student for about 10 to 15 minutes, and my strategy for interviewing them was to have them come into the office to get a password to access something online, and then I would just start talking to them. So I didn't say, we're going to have an interview now. I would just, you know, bring them in, ask them about the class, and in this way, I can, in real time, adjust the content of the course. I don't write all my notes ahead of time. I write my notes a week or two ahead of time, and so this way, the students have some input. They know it, and I tell them so. I had an evaluation from my department head who provides, you know, long-term expertise. Usually department heads are more senior and very experienced professors. And then I had actually two physics education researchers come and evaluate my course. Very complimentary information. Okay, so I just want to show you an example of these assessment tools. I'm not going to show you all the data because it's too much and I don't have time, but I show you a first example. Here is a kind of a couple of sample questions from the undergraduate quantum mechanics conceptual survey. So, you know, if we were doing clickers, by the way, I would have you vote on these answers. And this is a sort of a clicker exam. It's actually taken online. So, for example, you know, okay, you have an electron and a hydrogen atom in its ground state. Can you read that in back? I'm sorry, it's so small. Yeah, I see younger people with better eyesight are sitting in back. That's good. So, okay. all right, so the electron and a hydrogen atom is in its ground state. You measure the distance from the electron and the nucleus. So what are the possible results of this measurement? So how many people think that you'll definitely measure the distance to be the Bohr radius? I wish we had clickers, but raise your hand if you think that's true. Everybody thinks that's true? Okay. But if it was clickers, see, somebody would have clicked. Really. Because only a couple of people in here, you know, well, think that's true, right? Let's suppose a couple of people. But then they feel the pressure, the peer pressure, not to raise their hand. See? That's why clickers are really great, okay? So I won't do any more raising your hand here. You get my point. So B, you can measure any distance between 0 and infinity with equal probability. C, well, most likely it's at the Bohr radius, but it might be any distance, nearly any distance, it says, with the probability falling off exponentially as the distance increases beyond the Bohr radius. D, well, it's around the Bohr radius, more or less, but, you know, there's a de Broglie wavelength that says there should be a little uncertainty there. And then E, I have no idea how to answer this question, okay? So, and, you know, you'd be surprised how many students really can't answer this at the end of an undergraduate course. It's actually a substantial portion. And I won't go through the second question, but this is just about a plane wave. But I'll mention that, you know, one of the possible answers, you know, it's most likely to find a particle in the peaks or the troughs of the wave. Students really answer that. So people don't really, you know, pick up wave theory the way you think they're picking up wave theory when you're teaching in the class. So, you know, having this kind of data to prove that, right, through, you know, a quantitative assessment is absolutely essential and should be applied in every class, in my view, a pre and a post test. The survey that I invented, this is the first graduate survey ever written, I think, in physics education research, is open-ended. I believe in open-ended questions, not multiple choice, particularly for graduate students. I don't think graduate students need to go through multiple choice questions, okay? And so some of them are definitional and some of them are interpretational. For example, what's an entangled state? I was asked about earlier, right? Give an example of two and three particle entangled states based on direct products. What's a noon state? Give an example, okay? What's the difference between a coherent state and a number state? What are SU2 and SO3? How are they connected? Okay. So these are the kinds of questions I asked. There are 24 such questions. Let's look at the results. So the results are as follows. If I ask about the post-test score versus the pre-test score on an individual basis, right, I find that students really don't improve. You see how this is sort of scattered around a straight line going up? Right? That means that on an individual basis, students who did well on the pretest do well on the post-test. Students who did badly on the pretest do badly on the post-test. So going through a graduate quantum course over 3 years, I really don't find any statistically significant, I know it's a small sample, but for this small sample, I don't find any statistically significant increase in knowledge of undergraduate concepts. This was a horrible result for me, absolutely horrible. I was really upset. So because, you know, I just thought I'd totally fail in teaching quantum mechanics. I thought, you know, after going through a graduate course, shouldn't you know about a wave function? you know, and like wave theory, you know. So, and in fact, if I look at the final exam score, you know, which is a, this is of course a graduate exam versus this pretest or post-test, this undergraduate conceptual test, you know, there's absolutely no correlation, right? So, you know, these two pieces of data give some concrete evidence that in a graduate course, students are not really learning undergraduate concepts. But there's a bright side. On the other hand, if I ask about the correlation between the final exam score and the graduate quantum mechanics conceptual survey, it's very high. So what that means is, you know, in terms of a tool to measure actual ability to do a final exam, a conceptual survey is very informative. Now, remember, the final exam is 75% calculational, right? And these are hard problems, as you all know, who've been through this course or given this course. So I think it's very telling that a knowledge of concepts is tied to an ability to calculate hard problems. Okay. Now, before, we already knew this for first and second year classes, but we did not know that for graduate school. This is the first piece of evidence that this is just as true in graduate school. And I'll bet if you do this with 6,000 students, it'll converge on, you know, just a nice line here. Okay? We'll see. So the summary of the results, I've just mentioned. I just discussed the self-evaluations are very good for year-to-year improvement. It allows you to totally revamp a course from year to year. I think faculty should do that. I do. The student interviews help students to feel involved in the course content themselves and be invested in the class. They don't feel like it's something put upon them. It's something they're co-creating with the professor. And as long as you're open to that, I think it's a great way to proceed. And then finally, you know, having a department head look at your class is good, but it's good to get a complimentary evaluation from someone who does education professionally because they have a nice point of view. Let me emphasize, you know, as a person, you know, who, you know, waking and dreaming thinks about many-body theory, you know, all times in the shower, whatever, you know, I don't have extra time to do a lot of physics education research. Now, all of these methods fit right into my regularly scheduled office hours and normal class prep time. I did not spend twice as much time on this project as I would have prepping for a normal class. So the point is you can do these things without blowing your research career, and I think that's very important. Okay, particularly if you don't have tenure yet, but, you know, in general. Okay, so in conclusion, I told you about the textbooks. I told you that Sakurai, which I guess you're all using, unfortunately is dated. There is no pedagogically great replacement, according to student reviews. On the other hand, you know, new books can help. Okay, for example, having an axiomatic approach to quantum mechanics, incorporating all four periods of quantum mechanics. The course content I presented presents a sample syllabus. You can look through my paper and see how you can incorporate all four periods. In teaching methods, it's very important to have student-to-student and student-to-instructor approaches, not only me to you, but also you guys interacting with me and with each other. Okay? We all have something to teach each other. And then finally, in terms of assessment, what I discovered is that undergraduate skills are separate from graduate skills. You know, you'd think they'd be integrated, but my study, at least my first study here, shows that they're not. Now, I'd like to see if that was replicated in another study. I found very strong evidence for that, but it's small statistics, so we'll see if that's really true. I think what's much stronger is that this graduate quantum mechanics conceptual survey shows that a knowledge of concepts is tied to an ability to calculate. Now, I think that's a very general physics education result that we can now extrapolate to graduate school with some hard evidence. Okay, so in terms of the outlook for this study, you know, using simulations for demonstrations is a good idea. You know, I'm probably not going to do, you know, some kind of, you know, nuclear accelerated experiment on the table here, right? But, right, it's a little big. But, you know, I could do something with a simulation, and those simulations can be very useful. So that's another thing that can be done in graduate courses. Obviously, we need a lot more data. I would welcome anyone who would like to engage in a study of quantum mechanics with me. I'm now studying undergraduate upper division classical mechanics on several fronts. And if you want to read about this paper, it's in press in American Journal of Physics. Thank you.